Okay, Simon, and if you look just over there in the distance, you can see the top of Big Ben just peeking over the horizon.
Oh, God, hello. This is the Simon and Joe film show.
Oh, hello, yes, I'm Joe.
I'm Simon.
And we're actually on my roof terrace, which is where we spend New Year's Eve. We had a party up here, Simon.
We did have a party up here.
We saw fireworks.
And there was beer, there was drinking, there
cocktails.
Was wrestling.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. You smashed some glasses.
I did smash some glass.
If I've made that point enough, you definitely smashed some glasses. But here we are, yeah, it's a lovely, lovely day, actually. There's a crisp wind in the air.
There is.
And we've got some films to talk about this week, Simon.
Yeah, luckily we've got, as everybody has seen on Facebook, I have seen 127 hours and the King's Speech.
Pick one, Simon. Which one are you going to review this week?
The King's Speech.
Brilliant.
127
okay.
hours we're going to hold back on.
Hold back on that one. Okay, so you've got the King's Speech to look forward to. There's plenty of news, obviously. The start of the year, lots of news stories being released. It's new. That's what it is. It's a year.
And then we're going to finish up with some reviews of no other than Machete.
Which is a film I saw early this year, but was kind of one of last year's films. And you saw, of course, Deliverance, which is on the 1001 Films to See Before You Die book.
Yes, it is.
So
yes,
you were ticking boxes, so to speak. Yeah, so here we are, lovely London, looking out over the horizon.
I feel the breeze, Jesus.
Yeah,
it's just a bit chilly.
All right.
Okay, let's
chill
go
out
inside
and
review the King's Speech, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, let's definitely go from there. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're here for the main review this week, and in the red corner, it's Simon Colum. There's no one in the blue corner, I haven't seen it. Simon, what film are we talking about? It's not a boxing film.
No, it's not. It's The King's Speech.
Sounds like a period drama, I'd say, about royalty.
Yeah, well, it is very royal. It's a story, it stars Colin Firth, it's directed by Tom Hooper. It's about, basically, Colin Firth is, I'm gonna, just so we can just clarify, kings and queens, you know, like when you get King Edward or King, oh sorry, King, yeah, King Edward and King George, that's not actually their names.
No, no, yeah, I know. It's like popes. They don't use their real names. They pick a name.
It's
quite, you know, as if royalty didn't have enough privileges, they get to choose a name and choose a second birthday. Brilliant.
So this is about, I mean, we get really confusing because Colin Firth plays King George the Sixth slash Albert slash Bertie. So, you know, he plays this guy, and obviously before King George the Sixth became King George the Sixth, he actually had to take the throne because his brother abdicated, and he also had a debilitating stutter, and it was awful. It was really problematic. He wouldn't do very well on a podcast, shall we say?
No, shall we say that? I mean, we should also point out that Helena Bonham Carter is in this film as his wife, who actually, I mean, because this is a real story. I mean, this is real history we're talking about here, a real representation of what happened. She plays the Queen Mother, or the person that we know as the Queen Mother. Obviously, George died before he was really in our consciousness, but obviously the Queen Mother survived till she was over 100.
Yeah.
So we really know who that is, but obviously Helen Bonham Carter is playing her here as a very young woman.
Yeah.
You know, so that's interesting to me.
No, that is interesting, and but it shows the process as this guy had to cope with such an issue, and then as, obviously, more importantly, he had to become king after his brother abdicated.
I mean, he was never meant to be king. That's the point, isn't it? And now he was forced in that position because his brother was in a relationship with a divorced American woman called Wallis Simpson. And so he basically had to, I mean, there's a lot of politics behind that decision. And I'm sure that's explored in the film. But, you know, that's a difficult part just before, in the 1930s.
Yeah, just before World War II kicked off. So that's even more, like, the pressures facing him was crazy.
Particularly important to have a king who can stir the people to feel strong, to stir the... I mean, he's essentially, in a way, the commander-in-chief of the British Army. So, you know, he has to stir people, make them believe that we can win this war. And he's up against people like Hitler and Mussolini, who are very good at doing that.
Yeah.
So he, you know, has to overcome this stammer.
I think now, if we can get a clip, let's have a listen.
What'll I call you?
Your Royal Highness. Then sir, after that.
How about Bertie?
Only my family uses that.
In here, it's better if we're equals.
If we were equals, I wouldn't be here. I'd be at home with my wife, and no one would give a damn.
Well, please don't do that.
I'm sorry.
I believe sucking smoke into your lungs will kill you.
My physicians say it relaxes the throat.
Well, they're idiots.
They've all been knighted.
Makes it official, then.
Fascinating stuff, Simon.
Okay.
Going in, this film has got a lot of buzz.
Won the Toronto's audience choice, I think it was.
Go for it. And, of course, Colin Firth didn't win Best Actor last year at the Oscars for A Single Man. In preparation for this, they're saying this is the role he's going to win Best Actor for. You know, it's debatable. But and it's got a great... It's got Michael Gambon in there. Great British cast. Timothy Spall as Winston Churchill. These are all characters that we know. So... These are all actors we know, and they're all people playing people that we know. So, but it's still an overlooked part of history, I think.
Yeah.
What did you feel going into it? You were obviously excited about this buzz.
I was excited about it. I thought it was going to be really good. I thought there was obviously a side of it, which is the whole royalty type film, where I was like, oh, it's probably just going to be a royalty type film. But obviously, I like Colin Firth. He was great in A Single Man. So there was lots of good things going on about it. I obviously saw it shortly after 127 hours. My expectations were pretty high. Nothing out of this world.
No, okay, big time. We haven't even mentioned Geoffrey Rush yet, who plays the Australian speech therapist who is trying to help the king overcome his stutter. So I guess, I've heard it described, there's a kind of a bromance that comes up between those two guys. From what I could see of the trailer, it looks like there's obviously a very regal presence to it. It's a very important historical story. And at the same time, there's a sense of fun that there's this royalty meeting this Australian commoner. And that, their relationship, there's a chance to kind of laugh at that, but also to realise the importance of the war, the chance to explore 30s Britain, royalty in 30s Britain, which is,
I think I'm going to get stuck into my review, as it were. It's incredible. I absolutely loved this film. This is something where I thought it was going to be good, but I had no idea the emotional impact it has. And that's not, I wasn't in tears, but, there were, multiple points where it really, really comes home. And I was welling up. Emotion was in my face.
Wow.
As I have said before.
Wow.
When emotion's in your face, it's good. And I think, Tom Hooper directs this, and I think his direction of it, there was a lot of shots whereby he's kind of tracking behind Colin Firth, which is all gives him a real presence and makes you kind of feel like you're following him around, and that's really great. So, but I don't think there's anything incredible really about all the different kind of situation in terms of how it's shot. It's just the story itself, and more importantly, all the characters and the actors in it are just incredible. I mean, we haven't mentioned Guy Pearce, who plays his brother, and he's Edward, King Edward. Or his actual name is David, but he's a really, really brilliant in it. Derek Jacobi plays an archbishop, the Archbishop of Canterbury, I guess.
I think the problem for me is that here are all these, this is a story about privileged people overcoming problems. How does it kind of engage you? Because, I don't care if the king has us, sort it out, mate. Don't bother me with your trivial problems. But I guess what you really have to, the actors have to do is make you connect with these people, and that's obviously what happened, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I think that's because one of the underlying tensions is the fact that Lionel, who is Geoffrey Rush's character...
Who is a character that you would identify with most easiest as a commoner.
Yeah, but his role, on one side obviously he's a speech therapist, but on another point he's trying to kind of... Well, I don't know if he's trying to do this, but inevitably he does, in terms of his methods of dealing with speech therapy is about getting to the root cause of it, dealing with personal issues, and that's something which Colin Firth's King has very difficulty in doing. He doesn't want to open up, especially in the first instance, but he has to. One thing, when they first start discussing, Lionel's, Colin Firth's character keeps referring to him as Doctor, and he's like, it's Lionel. And he says to the king, he says, I'm going to refer to you as Bertie. And he said, only my family calls me Bertie. And he goes, well, in my rooms, you go by my rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that. So I think there's a certain element of taking him down a peg or two.
Breaking him down so the audience can then be like, okay, this is an ordinary guy who can, he's just in an elevated position.
Yeah, and I think that's one side to it, which, it's all about the fact that the working class man in Geoffrey Rush's character who wants to be in an amateur dramatic society, and then you have the king who has all these pressures on him, and is in a very privileged society. But ultimately, as privileged as he is, he's got so many pressures. And this is where the film takes on a really, I say multiple layer. I don't, you know, they're not that, it's not too deep in that regard. And that's what makes this even more emotionally impactful, because it's not really deep, but it does have multiple layers. In that the pressures which is on Colin Firth's character is that there's pressures on him as the king, as the fact that he is going to have to, you know, be this very powerful figure and deal with that. Secondly, he is seen as the voice of the people, so he represents the people and the working man and all that type of stuff. And that's a pressure unto itself. It's something he doesn't want. And more importantly, I think the whole challenge of him dealing with this stutter, dealing with these pressures, is something which every single person deals with. Especially, and I think it's not sexist to say, but I think the pressures of him as a man plays a part into it. In that, as a man, it forces you to face up to the challenges. It forces you to say, are you who your parents want you to be? Are you who your friends or your lovers want you to be? Are you who you want to be? And that's the challenge which faces him, and it breaks it down. And I think all these different layers, all these different themes which come through in the script would never have been possible. If anything didn't work, if Jeffrey Rush was not as playful and yet flawed to some extent as he is, you know what I mean, then it wouldn't work. If Colin Firth was not as impeccable, I mean, within the first like 10-20 minutes, less than that, you believe he is, you know, who he is. You don't think of him as the dude in Bridget Jones. You don't think of him as, you know what I mean, anything else other than who he is. And that's such a testament to his acting. I mean, he's an incredible actor. If he doesn't win Best Actor at the Oscars, I'd have to see the other films which are up against it, really. But the point is that, I mean, Jesse Eisenberg, I reckon he'll be nominated for Social Network, definitely. But
he's too young, isn't he, really?
But the point is that the role that Colin Firth has in The King's Speech is so huge, and yet he carries it. That's what means he should win.
Okay, I mean, my problem, I mean, obviously we've already established I haven't seen this. I've seen the trailers. I think the trailers are very unimpressive.
I'd agree with you. I think, but then it's very difficult because ultimately it is about royalty. It is this British royal film. How you can get all these things across in the trailer is very difficult.
That's my problem. It seems very twee. It seems very posh. Very, you know, we're the royal family. Isn't it jolly? We haven't really talked about Helena Bonham Carter. You know, oh look, she's sitting on her husband's chest. Isn't this funny? Because they're posh. And oh look, he's having to shake his mouth out. Isn't it funny? Because he's posh. And oh look, I mean, it's not in the trailer, but he swears a lot because, you know, that's a form of therapy. And it's funny because he's posh. I can't really get on board with that. I'm really interested in this period of history. I'm reading a book by William Boyd called Any Human Heart, which is a story basically of the 20th century through one man's eyes. And he has a perception of the abdication of Edward/David, which is really interesting, and obviously played by Guy Pearce, that's a really interesting part of the story, and a real part of the story, and a part of English history, which is fascinating to see, you know, what a different part. I mean, he's a Nazi sympathizer in some ways.
Yeah.
So what part history would have taken, really interesting in that sense. I guess it doesn't explore that too much, or?
Well, it explores his personal life. I think Edward's politics, it doesn't really. It just shows that he's not very good. Politics, I guess, and it's quite simplistic, I guess, his story, in that he's ultimately, his role is, he is the king that shouldn't be, he'd be a bad king, he's not very good at it, and he doesn't really think much of the trappings of royalty. Now, mentioning Helena Bonham Carter, I think she might be the key into making this, actually, maybe outside of that, like, royalty, like you're saying about the posh playfulness. And I think it's because
she's funny.
Well, because she's got this very clear difference between how she... Because you see her, obviously, with Colin Firth when they're alone, and you see how she speaks to people, like, when she first meets Jeffrey Rush's Lionel. And, you know, she has a different persona. She understands when she has to be the queen, quote-unquote. Mm, mm. She understands when she has to be the loving wife. And she's actually, you know, and they kind of... I don't think they mock it, but they see the trappings of it, but they also see the importance of it. And I think, you know, you have to be able to appreciate the monarchy to watch this film. Otherwise, the whole thing, you'll be a bit like, you know, it's pointless. But then again, you kind of, you, I don't know, maybe you don't, because obviously it's about the fact that the monarchy is seen as important, and therefore it is something which he has to live up to. But I think there is a clear balance between how they need to present themselves as a king or a queen or a duke or a duchess, whatever, and what, and the side of it which is less, less, you know, more personal.
Okay. Well, we look forward to hearing, obviously it's a hearty recommendation from Simon, we look forward to hearing other people whose emotion is in their face when they watch it, and and yeah, and we'll look forward to seeing if I am persuaded to see it.
Okay, so the news, Joe, what have you got for us?
Well, my first story this week is kind of an amendment to last week. We did our top tens. Now we've got Quentin Tarantino's top 10 films of 2010. And the thing I love about Tarantino is that he just goes all over the place. I mean, his number one film, for example, is bloody...
Toy Story 3.
Yeah, which is obviously a lot of people's best film of last year,
yeah.
But you wouldn't expect it to be Tarantino's best film of last year. He's got Enter the Void in there at number 10, and he says that has one of the best credit sequences in cinema history,
yeah.
which is a pretty impressive claim, which obviously makes me interested to see it, as if I wasn't already interested. And, you know, and he's got stuff in there like Greenberg at number 8, he's got a load of animated films. He's got Tangled at number 5. Does that make you excited about Tangled?
Well, see, this is the Rapunzel Disney story. It's got some... there was an article only recently in Sight and Sound about how Disney have kind of fallen off their kind of credible bandwagon. I mean, I think Pixar is kind of the main thing which they're pushing, but outside of Pixar, there's very little which they've got going for them. I think they're still making their money, but the point is that DreamWorks is now very, very powerful, and there are other animation studios doing very well as well.
Well, he's also got How to Train Your Dragon in there at number 17, so another animated film, and as a slap in your face, he's got Robin Hood at number 18. Not happy about that song.
No.
So, Tarantino losing credibility in your mind. And then he puts Night and Day at number 12, which, you know, nobody likes. I mean, Tarantino doesn't care. He'll just put whatever he wants. He's got no agenda here.
We liked Night and Day.
I did, yeah.
We didn't like it so much that we put it in our top 10. But, I remember coming out of that film and both of us having seen it saying, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, weren't brave enough to put it in our top 10. We didn't think it was good enough. Tarantino's like, What the hell? I don't care. I'm going to put it at number 12 in my top 20 films of the year. So, well done to Tarantino. And I'm excited to see what he feels about next year's films.
Yeah, no, indeed. Next up, we've got some casting news. Yes. Now, this casting news is regarding Robert Pattinson. Now, Robert Pattinson, as we know, is from Twilight. He has actually replaced Colin Farrell.
Robert Pattinson is from Twilight. Why aren't there teenage girls screaming right now? He's quite the fella, isn't he? He's popular with the ladies.
Well, he is. This is it. But more importantly, he's actually replaced Colin Farrell on David Cronenberg's new film, Cosmopolis.
So this is kind of giving him some credibility. Now filmmakers like David Cronenberg are casting him. That is making him more than just this teenage heartthrob. I mean, you know, lest it be forgot, he's younger than us, and yet he is already more famous than Jesus.
Well, I think it's funny because, you know, you've got this kind of... Maybe Colin Farrell, who used to be the poster boy, is just... He's fading out. I mean,
he's coming back now. I mean, he's just had The Way Back, where he's got, you know, some positive reviews for that.
Yeah.
He's left the ignominy of Alexander and, you know, those whole few years where...
He's done that London Boulevard.
Yeah, so, you know, he's doing grittier films, maybe. And, you know, so Colin Farrell... And he did Ondine, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, he's done a lot of slightly weirder stuff in recent times, and Cronenberg would be a perfect kind of addition to that. I mean, lest we forget, it was Joel Schumacher that gave Colin Farrell his break in Hollywood with stuff like Tigerland and such like. And, of course, Phone Booth, which was really what launched him on the mainstream. But now, I guess... I don't know why he's quit, if he's been fired. I'm sure there's more to come. But Cronenberg's a great filmmaker. And can he turn Robert Pattinson into a great actor?
Possibly.
I mean, he's done great work with Viggo Mortensen in the last few years and really given Viggo Mortensen a dark and violent edge. Will he? I mean, Pattinson is already dark, but will he get the violent? I mean, that will put people off. I've got a feeling, you know, is this going to be Cronenberg's first 12A film?
Well... Another thing which won't put people off, I doubt, is news of The Hobbit. And apparently Elijah Wood is going to reprise his role as Frodo Baggins.
Okay, I mean, because this is like a prequel. And we're already like 10 years after the original Lord of the Rings films. Are they going to have to de-age him a la Jeff Bridges in Tron Legacy?
Well, funnily enough, the story of The Hobbit is set, as many Lord of the Rings fans will know, not me, I haven't really read them, but the point is that it's all set many, many years before Frodo. So it's all about Bilbo.
They're going to have to de-age Ian McKellen as well.
Theoretically, that's true.
A lot of de-aging to happen here. I'm a little bit sceptical of the purpose. Like, I mean, a lot of people complain about Jeff Bridges' mouth. So I don't know if people are going to be complaining about Elijah Woods. He's a baby-faced guy, so maybe he can get away with it.
But he won't be a major role, people are assuming. Though he's definitely in it. It looks, from the news, it looks like he's probably going to be like, "Hello, my name's Frodo Baggins, and I'm going to tell you a story called The Hobbit." And then a book is going to open, and it'll be like, doo-doo-doo. And then at the end of the films, it'll be like, "And that's The Hobbit. I'm Frodo Baggins. See you next week with the Lord of the Rings story."
We'll definitely see you next week with the Lord of the Rings story. Those are films already in the bag, so to speak. Another film that's in the bag is Monsters. We spoke about it a lot last year. Got a bit of buzz. Wasn't in Tarantino's top 20. I wonder if that's because it wasn't released in America yet or some such. But anyway, I didn't like it very much. You liked it a lot. And now here he is already, I mean, this seems like a mighty promotion for young Gareth, already being linked to directing a new Godzilla film.
So yeah, this is very interesting. Originally, there was an assumption that Tim Burton was going to direct this, but he's kind of been taken off it by the looks of things. He was circling the project, so Slash Film has said. But fact of the matter is that no, Gareth Edwards is now attached officially with Legendary Pictures for Godzilla. Now, the last Godzilla I recall is the classic 1998 film directed by Roland Emmerich, which, if I remember rightly, was just Jurassic Park meets Alien with Matthew Broderick, therefore ruining, Jean Reno. Yeah.
I never saw the original Godzilla. It was an absolutely massive flop. It's odd, because recently I was watching some music videos, and one of the Puff Daddy song, the song that he did for it, came on, which is a great song, great video. And I think the discussion was the soundtrack was actually better than the film. It had some, you know,
Jamiroquai.
Loves it. But now here we are, and Gareth Edwards and is linked to direct. I can't believe that. You know, that he's gone so quickly into this stratosphere. I mean, obviously, Monsters, I didn't like it very much, but it got a lot of attention for what it achieved with so little money. So now they're going to give him, you know, $100 million, and what's he going to do with it? Is he still going to be working on his computer at home?
Maybe.
Creating the monster?
Maybe it'll be like Godzilla, Monster Star, so we won't ever see Godzilla.
Maybe that's what the problem was with the 1998 version.
Yeah, saw it too much.
More Matthew Broderick, please, and less Monster.
Yeah, maybe Matthew Broderick will be recast. He needs some help. Robert De Niro, on the other hand, with starring at the moment in Little Fockers.
Oh,
he's How the
Stop
Mighty
swearing,
Have Fallen.
Simon,
How the Mighty Have Fallen. He's actually heading the 64th annual Cannes Film Festival.
So climbing back up the ladder. Obviously, he does his Tribeca Film Festival in New York, kind of created post September the 11th. He is obviously on this festival circuit. He, you know, everybody's aware of what a big deal Cannes is, and now he gets the chance to award the Palme d'Or. It's obviously a jury head which will garner a lot of publicity. We had Tim Burton last year, so that you know, made people think. He made $1 billion with Alice in Wonderland last year, so he's artistically brilliant.
Oh yeah.
And Robert De Niro, who has let himself down with stuff like Little Fockers, now trying to get himself back. I mean, he's got Stone coming out. I think that's already out in America.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is with Ed Norton, which is more of a gritty
thriller.
Yeah, I guess. So, you know, he's mixing it up, and I think the Cannes Film Festival jury is a perfect place for him to be. You know, he'll be Frank, and we'll be Joe and Simon.
Yeah. So, okay, so that's De Niro doing Cannes. Now let's go a bit more local and think about what's happening in London.
Yeah, a bit of London news for you now, Simon. You teach in Hackney. Bloody exciting area, isn't it?
It is a bloody exciting area.
Bit dangerous,
no,
isn't it?
You've never been
physically intimidated?
Nope.
No, it's a lovely area, and it's going to get even lovelier with a new cinema, an independent cinema run by the Picture House chain. Yay, Picture House, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, this is worth, for all our international listeners, the Picture House chain are the people who run the Ritzy.
And the Clapham Picture House.
And the Clapham Picture House.
In the name,
and we went to the one in Bath, not in Bath, sorry, in Brighton.
Yeah, the Duke of York's.
That's Picture House.
A lovely one-screen cinema. And there's also, I've seen the one in Oxford, but I've never been in there. And there's one, there's one in Notting Hill I've never been to. And there's one in South London, Greenwich. I've been to the Greenwich one. I saw Revolution at the London Film Festival. So they're dotted around all over the place. Several in London, a few around the place, and now a new one in London, taking over the old Ocean in Hackney, which used to be a music venue, so, you know, big, lots of rooms, and it's going to be a four screen cinema with three bars. So obviously Picture House going from strength to strength, Hackney hopefully going from strength to strength. I know that the Ritzy really regenerated the Brixton area.
Yeah.
So hopefully it can do the same for where you work.
Yeah, no, I think hopefully in time we'll be able to go down there and record a podcast. Happy, happy days.
Yes, less happy days, the tragic news of Pete Postlethwaite's death.
Yeah, at the age of 64,
yeah.
He's obviously an actor who I think he's great. As a Jurassic Park fan, he was in The Lost World. Obviously, he's done much better things than that. But the fact of the matter is that I knew him as a wee boy back in 97.
I think we can talk about our classic memories. My classic memory, as soon as I heard the news, was of Romeo and Juliet. He plays a priest in that, and it's a great part. And, of course, there's The Usual Suspects. It's interesting. I saw him on stage a couple of years ago as King Lear, which was a fantastic performance completely. I mean, you know, he's also a theatre actor, so, you know, got to give him respect for that. And, you know, even more respect. In the last year, he was in Inception, The Town, and Clash of the Titans. So he made, at the box office, over $1 billion last year. He was a pretty impressive force there. And The Town, in a lot of people's top tens, or, you know, like Stephen King and Tarantino, both put it in their top ten. So, you know, and still making, essentially, great films.
Yeah, I mean, so it's a real tragic loss, and apparently, and Spielberg said he is the best actor in the world.
I think he said probably the best actor in the world. I think, you know, that quote has been slightly butchered, but he is a very, very good actor, and he's got a film coming up called Killing Bono. We'd all like to kill Bono.
Okay, so it's time now to speak to some of our friends in the interactive world. So let's go down the club, Joe. Ooh, I'm feeling that.
Are we in a club now?
We are in a club now.
I feel like we're still in my front room, but okay.
But you can hear the music in the background.
Oh, brilliant. Who's in this club, Simon?
Well, one of them...
Apart from us, obviously, we're in it.
Well, one of them is our Twitterer of the week, no other than Mr. Peter Bradshaw.
Wow, legendary film reviewer from The Guardian. I tweeted him. I was very impressed with his reviews on Friday. I'm always very impressed by him, but in particular, I enjoyed every single one. We'll come to that in more detail in the new releases section. But he followed us straight back, so thanks very much for that, Peter. I hope you're listening to this show.
Yes.
I hope you're enjoying this show.
Yes.
And I hope you continue to listen, and eventually we form some kind of synergetic partnership between Peter Bradshaw at The Guardian and the Simon and Joe Film Show on Podomatic. That's my hope. And
well,
what's your hope, Simon? I mean,
Peter's
in the club with us now, so you can talk to him directly.
My hope is that Peter Bradshaw gets lots of followers, because he's already got that 2,000 or something. Like, he's all right, but like, if you want to follow him, his is @PeterBradshaw1. So hunt him out onto Twitter.
And he's great. He's a film reviewer. He does, you know, film reviews for The Guardian. He's great. Who is Simon, our Facebook user of the week? I can see him in the distance in the club, but I can't quite pick out who it is.
Oh, you say he. It's in fact Whitney from the Frankly My Dear podcast. And she's actually turned around and said that she was keen about our enthusiasm for Shutter Island. And Mike McKenney said the same thing. And I've got to tell you again, I do think it's that good a film. I do not change my 2010 feelings. It is my favourite film of that year. It's that good.
And look at that, chatting to Whitney right now. It's our blogger of the week. Is that the man who writes The Dark of the Matinee, I see?
Oh, yes it is. Oh, no other than the Mad Hatter. And he's our blogger of the week, because
He does a legendary blog. I mean, we all know the Mad Hatter.
Oh, yeah, indeed. And the thing is that he's actually, his blog, he's just started a new weekly feature, which is going on about all the films he's watched in the last week. And in the last week, he's watched, like Miramax, Fried Green Tomatoes, Alexander, Ondine, New World, Night of the Hunter, Single Man, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So eight films.
A lot of Colin Farrell in there, to be honest.
Eight films he's watched.
Yeah.
Plus Lawrence of Arabia. Now, you know, Lawrence of Arabia is a bloody long film, and he's done 8 films. I don't even know how that's possible.
No.
I mean, that is just nuts. How many films he has watched.
Living in a dream world.
Well, not maybe living in a cinematic world.
Okay, well, let's wave goodbye to our friends in this rather stylish club. Bit futuristic.
We'll come back next week,
yeah,
I think.
And see who's joined us then.
Yeah, definitely.
Wow, that was an amazing club to be in.
It was.
I hope people want to be in that club all the time, because the music is fantastic and it's so much fun. The London box office, Simon, we can't cover this week because time out are still pretty slow. We can talk about the UK box office. At number 5, The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader? No, that's Treader.
Okay, what would you rather watch? The Chronicles of Narnia trilogy or the Twilight trilogy? Or
oh, wow.
There's more films.
Tough
Which
question.
One would you do?
Tough question.
Because I've seen neither. And I think both of them have got a certain, like, you should watch them. The Bangle
Rep. Well, no, neither of them have got a you should watch them.
No,
both
okay.
of them. They're
Twilight
thinly veiled religious allegories.
Yeah,
that are
true.
On some level quite offensive, and on another level quite boring. I would rather watch, I guess, the Twilight.
Yeah,
ones.
I think me too.
I think so. You know, the vampire's just more exciting than
yeah.
than talking animals.
I think so.
So
yeah.
I'm not at all excited. I mean, I saw The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Obviously, it's a classic book. I didn't think the film was that impressive. Tilda Swinton was fine. And the kid, you know, it's a kid's film. So I'm not at all interested.
New release, The Way Back, is at number 4. This is Colin Farrell.
Yeah, it's doing very well.
A Holocaust story, is it not?
No, it's a Gulag
wolf.
Story.
Gulag, sorry.
And a long journey. Ed Harris is in there. It's obviously directed by Peter Weir. I think it's got generally pretty good reviews. I think it deserves to be at number 4, and it is a film that I will be interested in seeing. The epic journey is of interest to me.
Your favourite film of 2010 at number 3, Love and Other Drugs.
I really loved this. It's interesting, actually. I was in a restaurant the other night, a Japanese restaurant, if you're interested. I doubt you are. And then this couple were talking, and I was vaguely eavesdropping, because that's the kind of guy I am. And they had just walked out of Love and Other Drugs. And
ooh.
I was like, wow. I saw it for free, and I didn't walk out, but that was because there was always a promise of a little bit more nudity from Anne Hathaway. But I would have walked out. It's a goddamn awful film.
But nevertheless, it's at number 3 because they made loads of money. Number 2, Little Fockers.
Yeah, I wouldn't even walk into this film, so...
I've had some weird... I was talking about films with some children at my school, and one of them turned around and said, I'd like to see Little Fockers, and I've got to kind of be like, yeah, should we... Well, I don't really want to... I don't really want to talk about this film, really. I feel like I'm, you know, I shouldn't condone your use of language.
You should have told him off for such offensive language.
But it's not his fault, really. It's Jay... What's his name? Jay Roach.
Jay Roach,
who's
and Ben Stiller, And Robert De Niro, who basically undermine their own, you know, intelligence by starring in shit.
Talking about undermining things, Gulliver's Travels, undermining Swifty.
Yeah, Jay Swift.
Swift Dog, yeah. You know, Gulliver's Travels, you know, it's actually at number 1. We were there saying we didn't think it'd done very well. It's actually at number 1.
In the UK. I mean, I think it's still considered a flop.
You know,
I mean, the Christmas period is notoriously difficult because people don't generally go to the cinema. So all these figures are generally down in terms of a general box office feel. So even being number 1, I mean, Tron Legacy didn't do as well as people hoped. It's already out of the top 5 in the UK. Although it took 100 million, you know, it should have taken more. 100 million worldwide, obviously not in the UK. That would be insane.
Well, funnily enough, looking at the figures, Tron Legacy is at number 6, and it's so far cumulative box office amount is £7,371, whereas Gulliver's Travels so far has made just over £7 million. So it's only 300,000 in between it, and yet it's had an extra 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And, well, I guess they're both in 3D.
Yeah.
Is Gulliver's Travels in 3D?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But it's been retrofitted rather than shot in 3D. I think generally this is a weak box office. It indicates, you know, that it's the holiday period and that there's a lot of kids' films in it, so we're not particularly interested. A classic week of new releases this week. I think we're going to try and cover as many as possible here.
Well, this is it. America has already had a bunch of these films. The fact of the matter is that we get them now. So when they have their kind of dry period in January, February, with no good releases, we get all the good releases from the Oscar successes, or the Oscar
successes.
Touted to be the Oscar successes.
Yeah, big time. So, of course, we've got The King's Speech, for which you've already heard a review, because Simon saw it. We've got 127 Hours. Simon's already seen it. We are banking that, because, you know, we'll talk about it in future
Hopefully
weeks.
Joe's going to have watched it.
Hopefully, big time. But in addition to that, we've got the next 3 days. A Russell Crowe film directed by Oscar winner Paul Haggis. I don't think this is going to trouble the Oscar categories, but certainly it's getting reasonable reviews.
It's
a remake of Anything for Her, which I think is a French film starring Diane Kruger. Basically, Elizabeth Banks goes to jail, and Russell Crowe is a husband who breaks her out, and Liam Neeson is in there. Not really of any interest to me. People are saying that it's, you know, it's got an extra half an hour above the original version, and that ultimately is kind of wasted, and it, you know. But it's Russell Crowe. I did see a TV spot, and all of a sudden Olivia Wilde popped up. And you know, I mean, she's so hot right now after Tron Legacy. So got to give props to Olivia Wilde, I think.
Okay, we've also got a release, which is, it's kind of a funny story, which is Zach Galifianakis and others.
And others, yeah. Well, Keir Gilchrist is a centrepiece. I mean, I remember this was at the London Film Festival. I saw a trailer for it. It seemed to be kind of funny, quirky, a bit indie. You've got to love Zach Galifianakis. Emma Roberts was in there. She seemed to be building up a reasonable head of steam. But now, I read Peter Bradshaw's review, 1 star. He says it's awful, and it kind of, it makes a romance of you know, people in a psychiatry ward, and that is kind of offensive.
Along the lines of the whole I'm Still Here, where Joaquin Phoenix pretends to be a nutter because he's not actually, and we're all laughing about it because it's funny. Well, next up, Joe.
We're talking about Able, which is directed by Diego Luna. Not a particularly big release, a kind of an international film, obviously. Diego Luna was a guy from Utu Mama Tambien, Rudo Akersi, big Mexican star, and of course was in The Terminal as well.
That was his
Hollywood breakout. But here he is directing, a very young guy to be directing, but, you know, certainly it's like an interesting film about a boy whose father leaves, so he then, you know, again, we're dealing with psychiatry here, he then supplants himself and becomes the father figure, and it's kind of a bit weird, but, you know, props to Diego Luna, I think, for taking something like that on, and interesting stuff.
Okay, one more, Joe?
Yeah, I've got Amir, A-M-E-R, I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
Not like Amir Khan.
No, it's a French film, not massively of interest. It's heavily influenced by Italian giallo films, horror films, so a bit weird. People are saying that, you know, kind of, it's a very artistic film, but ultimately there's not much structure there. Interestingly, Quentin Tarantino put in his top 20 films of last year, so obviously already out in America, and Tarantino, who will pick up these kind of random little films from all over the place, is giving it props. So I keep using the word props. I feel like, I don't know why.
You're using it to prop yourself up.
Yeah, I am propping myself up.
Okay, and I think that's really all we got. Trailers, we're going to try and do an actual blog post for that, so you can watch the blog, or watch it on the blog, and then see our comments, because I think when we talk about it, you're kind of missing the whole experience of actually watching the trailer.
And, of course, there's not many good trailers out at the moment. It's a kind of, it's a quiet time for trailers.
But alas, we've made sure that we've hunted down some classic films, which we will discuss after the break. Okay, so for the last part of today's Simon and Joe film show, we're talking about John Boorman's 1972 classic, Deliverance.
And Robert Rodriguez's Machete.
Machete.
His grindhouse film that grew out of a trailer from the original, with the Death Proof between that and Planet Terror. So that's bloody exciting. Simon, tell us a little bit about Deliverance. I see it's in the book 1001 Movies to See Before You Die.
Yeah, what's big about Deliverance is that it's in the same place as Straw Dogs by Sam Peckinpah and Wes Craven's Last House on the Left, in that it's like middle-class folk going out into these places and then finding out, and then in a very sexualized, violent way,
yikes,
they suddenly, everything goes a bit crazy and they have to get back to their roots, animalistic things, and deal with
to
it.
Survive.
To survive.
It's a horror film. It's very unpleasant.
Yeah, well, it is a horror film, but the horror is in very small chunks. I think what's quite strange about it is that, you know, it kind of makes these kind of country hicks or rednecks right out in the deep south and make them out to be very fearful people. The whole kind of things you don't understand or you don't know about scares you. And I think, you know, we've all been in that place where, you know, you go to a local pub for local people and you're thinking to yourself, whoa, I probably shouldn't have come in here. And it's basically taken that to a much bigger level. And obviously in America, it's so much of a bigger place that these kind of little pockets can be very unto themselves. People who don't even leave, like, huge, like, little areas of America for their entire lives. So they're very kind of, can be quite, they seem a bit mad.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you know about Deliverance?
I don't know much. I know it's very controversial, like those other two films you talked about, The Wes Craven, Last House on the Left, and Straw Dogs. I believe there's a rape in it, so...
There is.
Similar to those two films. And I think it's got Ned Beatty, and would I be right in saying
that's
that?
That's right. The actors are Burt Reynolds, John Voight, Ned Beatty, and some other guy who's generally not as famous.
Okay, so, but there are some big names there, John Voight, you know. And then and we're going to South America, not South America, Southern America, I'm sorry, and it's very brutal in the end.
Yeah, so it opens up as they're driving across these places, and they find this man-child. Have you ever seen a man-child?
No, I haven't, no.
There's a man-child, he looks a bit weird, but he's a goofy
kid. I'm guessing this is a bit weird.
Yeah, he's got a little banjo, and he plays it really freakishly well, and one of these four guys, they're all like city types, you know, so they're all quite, you know, ooh, we're on a crazy little jaunt, a canoe trip, we're gonna have fun. And so this man-child sequence with this banjo playing, because he's an amazing banjo player, is really weird and unnerving, and it kind of sets up this very fearful, like, these guys are freaks, they are weird, get away from them, that kind of thing. And then they get on these canoes and they start canoeing downstream, and then at one point John Voight and Ned Beatty get off the boat, and these two complete, like, countrymen, as they, I think, or country, mountain men, mountain people, turn up, and then just kind of, like, with gun, start, like, saying, we're gonna kill you, we're gonna kill you, and then there's, like, Ned Beatty, and they start saying, squeal, piggy, squeal, have you heard that?
Yeah.
And basically, Ned Beatty's then raped, and then John Voight is, you know, by one of the men, so it's male rape, and then John Voight, on the other hand, is, like, held at gunpoint to do a bit of the old, oral sex, but alas, it doesn't happen because Burt Reynolds' character comes out of the mists and gets his bow and arrow and kills them. So then the rest of the film kills one of them, even the other one runs away. So the whole rest of the film is kind of like, now what do they do with this body? Do they get rid of it? And one of the guys are like, well, no. But the other three are kind of like, yes. And Ned Beatty, like, doesn't want to wants to forget everything, and he definitely wants him dead. So I think there's a certain point about capital punishment. At what point do you condone it? Because in this situation, you know what I mean, you kind of think, well, fair enough. He deserved to die, this guy who was doing it. But then, maybe not. It reminded me a bit of Mean Creek. Do you remember that?
I never saw it, but I know the film that you're referring to.
I think it was, like, it was younger kids. I think one of the Culkins were in the cast. I remember seeing
it.
Very
Josh Peck was in it as well.
Okay, and it was similar in that. If I recall rightly, they were on a boat, and one of them died. I don't think it was obviously no rape in there. But the point is that it was similar kind of theme. And obviously the visuals in terms of all the canoe trips, all the kind of rocky rapids as they're going down the street, the woods, looks great. And that's definitely the thing. I mean, I felt like towards the end it got a bit drawn out, because then it kind of follows on from when they get to the land, about them kind of, you know, hiding, you know, kind of dealing with it. And what at first seemed like a good idea, that they kind of hide the body and that they'd win, it kind of ends on a pretty negative note, whereby John Voight wakes up in the night worried that he's going to be found out for the murder, and that's kind of like where it ends. So you're kind of thinking, maybe not, maybe he's got that horror which will haunt him for the rest of his life. It is a great film. I mean, it's quite, I think to some extent you could argue it's quite slow. It's quite fast, I think, when they're kind of on the boats and whatnot. But a lot, it's about that decision to kill somebody else and those animalistic feelings. Do you turn to them, and is it right? And, you know, across the four characters, they all have different stances. And obviously, Ned Beatty's character, who's very weak to some extent, he's like a salesman character, and yet he's the one who's raped. So then his attitude very clearly changes before and after, obviously, that rape. Course, so you see his attitude to the issue. Okay, like I said, I'd say it's a recommendation. It's definitely...
It's a difficult film, though. I mean, it's not for everyone.
No, it's not for everyone. But I think it does, like, tackle that big question about death and murder. And is there any context where it's right?
And, of course, if you tick off these 1001 films to see before you die, you're happy to have done that. That's one of the ones you deserves to be in the book.
Oh, yeah. No,
and, of course, there'll be ones in the book where you'll be like, what the bloody hell's that doing in there? And why isn't this in there?
Home Alone's not in there. Crazy.
Oh! Are you serious?
Serious.
How rude.
Anyway, okay, let's move away away then from Deliverance and male rape, and let's discuss Machete.
Okay, so Machete, also an 18 certificate, so we're expecting, not male rape, but we are expecting a lot of violence and bad language and a healthy dose of sex. This is, of course, a grindhouse film. We'll remember from a few years ago when we had the old Planet Terror and Death Proof, Double Bill, Rodriguez and Tarantino together, putting their fake trailers in the middle.
Yeah.
Machete was the best of those fake trailers, featured Danny Trejo. I mean, the most accessible of those fake trailers.
It was a theatrical trailer, anyway. Yeah. The other one seemed more... Oh, no, I guess not.
But anyway, it featured Danny Trejo as this Machete character, a goddamn federale, pissed off Mexican, basically with a massive knife out to kill everyone, and so they've extended that into a feature-length film.
Okay, so this is something which has got, like, I mean, Emlyn, a listener to the show, he said it's one of his favourite films of the year. It missed out, I think, on his top five only just.
Okay.
It's obviously going to be quite tongue-in-cheek. It's exploitative, so the violence and the sex and all that kind of stuff is going to be pretty crazy and out there. I guess it's not going to be taken seriously, but you tell us more.
Yeah, I mean, it is a good film. I'm going to start off and say it is a recommendation. It is, you know, if you've enjoyed those other two films that we've, you know, the other two grindhouse films from a few years ago, and it, you know, you will enjoy it. It's good fun, despite the fact it's very unpleasant. But for my money, it's not as good as those. I feel like, you know, when we're talking about violence, it goes to a certain point, and then it kind of stops, and it gets, you know, it kind of doesn't follow through. And when it's got the sex, it goes to a certain point, and then it just doesn't quite follow through. And when it gets the bad language, you know, there's some funny insults in there, but then it just doesn't quite follow through. There's just not enough of the randomness for me. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't cut away suddenly to completely nonsense stuff. The effects actually look quite good, which is kind of a problem, really. I want effects to look rubbish. And, I mean, you know, Danny Trejo is great. I got a problem with some of the other cast. Steven Seagal is in it as the villain, and it's funny because it's Steven Seagal, but he's not really that funny. He's got no funny lines. And the same with Don Johnson. It's funny because it's Don Johnson, but he's got no funny lines. Robert De Niro is not as bad as people say as a senator, but it's kind of pointless. He's just to move the plot along. Lindsay Lohan is absolutely awful. Her career, I mean, she seems to be grinning the whole time, like she knows it's a joke and she's in on the joke, when she should be overacting, and she doesn't do that at all. So this was the final nail in the coffin of her career, and it really has been hammered home. She's not coming back from this. Jessica Alba is fine, as so is Michelle Rodriguez, but they seem to take it a bit too seriously as an action film.
So your problem with Lindsay Lohan is she doesn't take it seriously at all, whereas these two take it too seriously. So you just want them to kind of find that middle ground.
Yeah. I think that's the problem. Ultimately, it's Danny Trejo's film, and that face is so in the hair. I mean, he looks perfect for the part.
I have seen.
Yeah, and his padre or his brother Cheech Marin is great in the, you know, in the part that he has. And you know, Jeff Fahey is fine as well. So there are people that kind of get the joke and know they have to be serious without being. I mean, I think what the fundamental problem is, and the theme of the film is it is trying to tackle a serious issue, which is immigration in America, which is an issue that needs to be tackled in a reasonable debate. But I don't know why it's trying to do that. There are other films it could do that in. So it's kind of stuck between being funny and then making a serious point about immigration, which needs to be made. And so it kind of flips between the two, and I'm just never really that switched on to either point, so I just kind of, you know, I get a bit lost, and you know, and that's kind of a problem. I guess the problem is it's just never really ridiculous enough for me. It's there are some good one-liners that make you laugh, but it's just not enough. So I would say watch it, don't go in with too high expectations. There will be some bizarre random stuff that you will enjoy, and there'll be some serious stuff you'll be like, huh? And the plot just isn't all over the place. And, you know, to be honest, with a grindhouse film, that's kind of a problem.
Are you looking forward to Hobo with a Shotgun to finish?
Not really. I don't think so. I don't know.
Is all your exploitation film do you feel like it's kind of run its course?
No, not necessarily. There's still potential there. I just don't think Hobo with a Shotgun has enough You know, if from the trailer, it's not clear. I mean, the trailer, if the film is all over the place, the trailer should really be all over the place. And Hobo with Shotgun still looks like it's got a theme running through it, you know,
a
narrative thread of Rutger Hauer with his shotgun. And that, for me, you know, I mean, the thing about Machete is that, you know, he's assassinating someone and then he's not assassinating someone, and he's having sex with a woman and then he's not having sex.
He gets the girl.
Yeah. Where are my wife and daughter? So there are great lines like that, but there's just not enough. You know, if they make Thanksgiving, I would be interested to see that. But, you know, I don't know. I think this is a misfire. It's a good film, but it's not as great as it could have been. And it's not as good as Planet Terror. And it's not as good as Death Proof.
Okay, right-o. Then that's Deliverance and Machete.
Machete.
Foolishly, we've come back outside again.
I don't know, it's still a lovely day, Simon. Look at the planes in the sky and
should have worn
the
a jacket,
wonderful
though.
Weather. Well, you know, we're only out here for a bit, just to wrap up this week's show, to say off to watch the old Liverpool Man United game on the telly. Bloody excited about that. Sorry, Simon, I know it's not film-related, I know we shouldn't be talking about it, but what film-related stuff do we have to talk about? Do we have treats for next week?
Well, we've got plenty to talk about. I mean, I'm thinking potentially 127 hours.
Potentially. But, then, you know, there's a lot of films released in January, so we're looking forward to plenty. I think it's going to be a good month. I mean, you've already essentially seen a couple of the best films of the year.
So I know, possibly.
You may as well hibernate.
Exactly. Well, yeah. You can hibernate, folks, for another week, because we'll be coming back next week with another film show.
And don't forget to check out the blog for Trailer Debate.
Oh, yes, indeed.
I believe you could.
That's good.
That's very good, sir.
God damn, you play a mean banjo.
The Simon and Joe podcast is part of screeninsight.co.uk. See you next week.